Real sports talk for real sports fans. It's Jimmy V and TC. Here's Jim and Trent.
All right, everybody, welcome back. It's our second hour as we get you on your drive home. Please drive carefully. All right, Trent, what are you going to do to me here? You threw the olive branch out and said that we are not going to argue in this segment. Is that correct?
We might end up arguing. You never know how things are going to go.
Okay, what do you got, kid?
Well, so earlier we were talking a little NFL. We got some more NFL coming up here. Vikings talk, obviously, the big talker here. The Patriots, sure. Yeah, the national team, but just the importance of getting over the hump. So I just made a comment today, and from time to time, this creeps up into my head, and you don't know exactly where it comes from or where deep inside the recesses of your memory bank you can get things. But we're talking about the surface and earlier today about this, about at the old Vet Stadium, you know, it was terrible there, and of course now it's terrible at Lincoln Financial Field. And a name popped into my head. He's a former Bear, and that's what the reason for it. Do you remember Wendell Davis? He was a wide receiver for a couple of years with the Bears in the early 90s. Do you remember that name at all?
I remember the name, yes. I don't remember any major accomplishments that he had, though.
He was a first-round pick for the Bears late in the first round when they were actually good and they had late first-round picks as opposed to what they had today. But I remember a game that he played in Philly, now different surface, obviously, at the old Vets, as opposed to what they're going to be playing on the grass here. But I remember him hurting both of his knees on a play. And so when it popped into my head, then I had to go back, and in between shows today, I went a little bit deeper. He, get this, playing on the AstroTurf at Veterans Stadium.
Yeah.
While planting his feet to catch an underthrown ball from your boy Jim Harbaugh, his cleats got stuck in the turf. The force of being pulled back to the ground was so severe, it completely severed the patella tendon in each of his knees.
Wow.
Doctors later found his kneecaps had been pushed all the way into his thighs.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh.
That's a bad injury. That's a bad injury. And I don't know why. I don't know where it came from or why I jumped in there. But, Jimmy B, this playing service, though it'll be better than old Vets, not going to be very good on Sunday. I've talked about that a couple of times this week, and I want to ask Sean Tomlinson and get his thoughts. Am I making too much of this, or is this a real deal for the game on Sunday?
No, it's a real deal. It's a factor, and both teams are stuck in the same boat with it. You saw Atlanta and you saw Philadelphia. Players both lose their footing in that playoff game. Trent, I was working in Philadelphia in the early 90s. I was on the Vets turf. It was like concrete, and to the life of me, I have no idea how players even survived playing on that artificial turf that they had at Veterans Stadium, because it was awful. The field that they have now is supposed to be so much better, but you go back, and you'll see Falcons players and Eagles players both slipping and sliding and tripping themselves as well on that turf.
I get that both teams play on it. You know, the old adage, well, team has an advantage. But Philadelphia's played on this turf. They know it. You're still going to slip at times, but I think there's got to be an advantage there. And you mentioned Atlanta. And just go back to the final play of the game. Julio Jones fell down in the end zone, got back up, and then, you know, his timing was thrown off as he went up trying to jump up for that ball because he fell down in the end zone. I just think it is going to be a bigger factor, the Vikings, as opposed to the Eagles. The Eagles, though they'll still slip, at least know a little bit. They have some kind of consciousness now. And I guess that's a problem with the Dome team. Though Minnesota is from Minnesota, and they could practice outdoors. They could practice, I'm sure, on some crappy field conditions if they'd like. I don't think you can be completely ready for it in a game environment. Maybe a slight edge to the Eagles. I don't know how big it is, but boy, I'm looking forward to that game. Jim, the Vikings fans, they've been fun this week talking with them.
Mm-hmm.
The beaming nature of it. It's that organization has had just so many tough losses. Do they final breakthrough? We'll make our official picks on Friday, but do you have the feeling, or is there still some trepidation? Because I'm still caught with that trepidation that this is the Vikings. Aren't they going to find a way to screw this up?
I'm not leaning to the point where it's the Vikings and they're going to find a way to screw it up. I'm more leaning to the fact that Philadelphia's defense is damn good.
Yeah.
And look how they were able to shut down Matt Ryan in that passing game. And the way that they handled Atlanta's running attack as well. I think people, if they think that it's the Vikings will be screwing this up, I don't think that's the way to look at it. I think it's going to be a low-scoring game, just like what we saw last week in Philadelphia. What was it, 15-10? And from that standpoint, I think that Philadelphia has a chance to win this game. Well, you're right. We will make our picks on Friday. But I just believe that Philadelphia's defense is as stout as the Minnesota Vikings defense is.
Well, I feel like I know where you're leaning, but we still got a couple of days before our official picks. And we're deadlocked in the picks, Jimmy B. We are both 53-43-3 against the number. That is with point spreads. It's not just picking winners. We're still both 10 games over 500. A good race with three left to go, Mr. Brinson. Well, we'll take a break here. We'll go to a real expert in the field of the NFL. It's our man, Sean Tomlinson from Bleacher Report. We'll get his thoughts on that, the weather conditions, the field conditions, a look back at the divisional round, and a look forward at the AFC and NFC championship games. We'll have Super Bowl coverage as well for you with Westwood One here on 1700 KBGG. We're talking NFL next with Sean Tomlinson, then Zuba Mahente from ESPN. They stop by next as we take you up until 6 o'clock on Jimmy B and TC.
The Kansas City Chiefs play here. 1700 KBGG.
Hey, everybody, welcome back in. We continue all the way till 6 o'clock. Jimmy B and TC on the Big Talker 1700. Always fun when we have a chance to get Sean Tomlinson in from Bleacher Report. We do some National Football League conversation with him, and he's on the line with us right now. Sean, good afternoon, man.
Good afternoon to you guys. I'm still kind of coming down from that Sunday and, you know, feeling sore for Marcus Williams a bit, to be honest. You know, it's hope that doesn't, get past that eventually.
Yeah, Marcus Williams, it's interesting. He had put together a nice season this year. You know, looked to be part of the future, certainly, of New Orleans as a team. Really transformed themselves. But a play like that, the mental state of it and what goes into it, how difficult of an offseason is it going to be for Marcus Williams, and how important for the Saints organization as a whole to keep this guy right mentally?
Yeah, I think and hope that, you know, yeah, obviously he picked the worst possible time to make a bad play. When you hear his comments after the game, there's just obviously these things happen so fast. There's so much chaos. There's a lot going through your mind. He wants to not have pass interference. He wants to, you know, keep him in bounds. Really, the worst case scenario for him there should have been Diggs catches it and somehow is able to get it out of bounds with a couple seconds left, and then the Vikings have to kick a long field goal, and that hasn't really been a gimme. So, you know, but, you know, that then you squeeze around. But I think he's a young enough guy, and, you know, he seems to be really, have a good football mind on it, and I think he can bounce back quick mentally. You know, it's obviously we're going to focus on that play, and that it's going to be replayed not just all off season, but every year in January. But what we're going to forget is that play wouldn't have mattered without Marcus Williams' interception late in the third quarter. Right. Mm-hmm. At that point, it's 17-7 Vikings. Yeah, they're starting to come back, but they need the ball back quick. There's not much time left, and he makes that play. He had five interceptions on the year, including that one. So he had a terrific season. And this is a Saints team that's really trending up fast, and he was part of the reason why that defense bounced back really quickly.
Having a conversation right now with Sean Tomlinson, Bleacher Report, NFL. All right, Sean, take me then to what we're going to see, because we won't get a chance to talk to you before Sunday. In your mind, how are these championship games in the AFC and NFC going to play out?
Well, I mean, first off, in the AFC, you've got a game that I've always said this throughout the, you know, for the last half of the year, and especially in the playoffs, and I get some weird looks, but I think if there's one team not named the Steelers that could knock off the Patriots, I really do believe the Jaguars have a chance. And more than just like a long shot chance, I know Vegas has them as 9.0 underdogs, but that defense is really, really good. And think back in the 2016 AFC Championship game between the with the Broncos, the way to beat Brady is intense, relentless pressure. The Broncos hit him 20 times in that game and just gave the Patriots no opportunity for any rhythm at all. Now, the way to neutralize pressure is, of course, with quick passes, slants, and they have Deion Lewis, who just went off for 148 yards from scrimmage. So there's going to be that sort of give and take there, and it'll be really interesting to watch to see how two really, really smart football minds between Brady and Belichick prepare for that Jaguars defense. With the Vikings and Eagles, it is just it's funny that we've gotten two teams in that game that really are very, very similar. We don't think of Casey Keenum as a backup anymore, but yeah, he entered the season as a backup and he's thrived. Nick Foles, of course, you know, Carson Wentz would have been the MVP, but you know the Eagles have managed him nicely. And two top five defenses that really swarm after the ball through the air, great secondaries, and terrific pass rushers. So, you know, two really, really evenly matched teams. That Vikings defense and what they're able to do with Rose and Waynes, it's going to be tough to trust Foles too much.
Talk with Sean Tomlinson, a look around the NFL. NFC Championship game, as you were just talking about it there, field conditions continue to be a big talking point this week. The Vikings, they play in Chicago, they play in Green Bay, but we know the comfy confines of U.S. Bank Stadium, it is a little bit different. Is this being overblown? Is this a bigger deal than maybe just a general football fan would think? Your thoughts on the field conditions and how they might determine who goes to the Super Bowl?
Yeah, I think that is a legitimate, you know, point of concern for any team that's spent much of their season at least half the season indoors. And you know, it's funny, if the Saints had won that game, we'd be talking about the Saints potentially playing, you know, all the playoffs indoors too, right? It'd be the same deal. I think though there is something to be said for a defense with the Vikings that's just been together so long. I mean, the core pieces of that defense have been together for at least 3, sometimes 4 years. So I think there's an element of communication there and adjustments that can happen in game and just sort of fight through any conditions. So, obviously both teams have to deal with it. But yeah, the bitter cold in Philadelphia could be the ultimate equalizer here.
Interesting. What we have in that matchup with two perennial backup quarterbacks, Nick Foles did have a run as a starter with the Eagles and was having a very successful season. Then that kind of came to an abrupt halt. Case Keenum struggled the entire time. Now he's having a phenomenal season with the Minnesota Vikings after taking over for the injured Sam Bradford. Is this one of the cool stories of the NFL, the way that two guys like this have evolved into what they are right now?
Yeah, if I gave you 100 guesses back in August to try and, you know, beyond just that game, the final four quarterbacks, you would get 100 guesses wrong. I mean, you'd guess Brady probably, but that'd be about it. You know, with Keenum, it's really a fascinating story in that the journeyman label is attached to him, you know, and I think a bit unfairly because he just never really was put in a good position to succeed and to show what he can do. The Jeff Fisher experience with the Rams wasn't fun for anybody involved, especially Case Keenum. And then you come here and, you know, the Vikings, he entering training camp there and throughout the off-season OTAs, he was in a competition and just have a roster spot. He's able to do enough when supported by a quality rushing offense and a great defense. But, you know, he can make really difficult throws, you know, during moments, you know, really precise, those looping sort of arching throws into tight spots. And he's more than just that game manager. Game manager to me is a guy who just, you ask him to not screw up much, but he can really put an offense out there. And we saw that, you know, the Diggs throw gets all the attention, but the throw to Adam Thielen as well, along the sidelines waiting the game to set up the field goal. And with Foles, I mean, this is the best compliment you can give him, and it is a legitimate one. He's a great backup. He is one of the league's best backups, and he's a guy that you can, you know, put in there, and he can do just enough, make the odd key throw. The problem is that he's a sort of backup where you don't want him in there for more than two to three games, and then now suddenly if the Eagles are going to win a championship, it's got to be with him.
Well, with the Steelers' loss over the weekend to Jacksonville, you figure there might be some heads rolling, and the first of those heads is out. Todd Haley out as the offensive coordinator. Now, his contract was set to expire here, so it's not an outright firing, if you will, but not renewing the contract with Haley, a surprise to you at all, or this is what's going to happen when you lose at home to Jacksonville?
I think it's what happens just with human relationships over time. There, you know, you have Tomlin and Haley on the same sideline in the same coaching room for a long, long time, and this is a guy who, one, is obviously the head coach, and then Haley used to be back in Arizona and wants to get back to that level at some point. I think there was a personality clash over time. I also think that Todd Haley will bounce back just fine and find a team, you know, willing to take him on pretty quickly with what he's done with that offense over the years. To think of just how many explosive games and high-level production they've had from Antonio Brown, Le'Veon Bell, an aging Big Ben. You know, Todd Haley is, you know, he's a great football mind. You know, just if you have him focus on offense, you know, if you put the extra responsibilities of a head coach with him, then, you know, he at times might grind away a bit on his players, because he's pretty intense. He's extremely intense, and that's also a concern with John Gruden, not to digress too much. But I think it was just perhaps time for a change, and the Steelers will keep humming along just fine as long as they find a way to keep Le'Veon Bell, obviously, and it sounds like Big Ben is staying around too.
Where does Tennessee go now? Now that they've said goodbye to Mike Mularkey, are they in the... My old partner Ken Miller used to call him Josh McBlunder when he was a head coach at Denver. Are they in the McBlunder sweepstakes, or has Indy pretty much wrapped that one up?
It sounds like McDaniels is heading towards Indy. That's sort of unofficially official. You know, it looks that way. You know, we're going to have to kind of wait it a bit out to see what the Titans could do, you know, in terms of the coaches currently out there. You know, you see a guy like maybe Mike Vrabel with the Texans. They scheduled an interview with him. Matt LaFleur, the Rams offensive coordinator as well. Potentially Steve Wilks with the Panthers. There's a bunch of names sort of bouncing around. The difficulty is that, of course, that they're a little late to the head coach searching party. Obviously, teams like the Bears got that started quickly, and we're now into mid-January when that carousel is starting to spin a bit slower. You know, what's really disappointing or frustrating about the Titans is they have so many promising young pieces. Obviously, Mariota, Derrick Henry, what he did, 191 yards from scrimmage and the playoff win. You know, and you just need an offensive-minded coach who can get the most out of that really talented young quarterback and get him back to where he was a couple years ago. And yes, you need him to be successful from the pocket, but still explore his athleticism, because that's how he's going to be able to push that offense down the field to win games. And just as a neutral fan, it's just so much fun to watch that version of the Titans when they've been able to do that, and Mike Mularkey just wasn't the guy.
All right, Sean, we'll let you go. Let's get you on the record. Who are we going to see in Super Bowl 52 to the north of us up in Minnesota?
Oh man, I know I just said the Jags could beat the Patriots. I just don't have the courage to put my name on that. Yeah. So I'll still go Patriots, but if I'm a betting man, take them against the spread, the Jaguars, and Vikings too.
Yeah, going with the favorites. I think a good call there. Sean, as always, good talking with you. We'll do it again soon.
Anytime. Thanks so much.
Sean Tomlinson from Bleacher Report talking NFL with us. Jimmy B, odds are out, as they always are on all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Your Super Bowl matchup odds. I like to take a peek at these ones. So, as you'd expect, the two favorites, Patriots, mm-hmm. Vikings at the top. So you can bet, though, the exact outcome of Super Bowl 52. So right now, if you put a bet down, Patriots beating the Vikings, it's 2-1 odds. All I have to do is win. Okay. No point spreads involved. You just need that. You get 2-1 odds. Patriots beating the Eagles, 7-2. Vikings over the Patriots, 3-1. The biggest long shot on the board, though, the Jaguars beat the Eagles. You can get that one at 21. You taking a fire at that long shot, Jimmy B?
I'd take a fire at the long shot. Heck yeah. I'd throw 50 cents on that. You bet.
You can't bet 50 cents, Jim Brinson.
Well, my wallet is pretty thin. You know that.
It's not thin. It's about as thick as you're going to find. You don't spend anything out of it. That's the problem. Well, Jimmy B, we got to take a break. We'll come back. Put a cap on things. Our old friend Zubin Mahente from ESPN. He'll stop by next as we take you up until 6 o'clock tonight. It's Jimmy B and TC.
And welcome back, everybody. We wrap things up on the program today on a Wednesday in the capital city. Headed out to beautiful Bristol, Connecticut. ESPN Zubin Mahente joining us right here on the Big Talker 1700. Hi, Zubin. How are you?
Guys, doing well. Snow today here, but Trent was just telling me off the air. It's warming up by you guys.
Finally, we're going to feel like when we get to 40, I'll have the roof open on the car and the windows wide open. You can count on that. Hey, help me out here, Zubin, will you please? All of a sudden, the last couple of days in the NBA, we have seen some rough stuff. We saw it in the Clippers game and then again last night as well. What's your take on that? How did the NBA run off the rails here the last couple days?
I think it's a real thing. I was actually on with Trent and Ken earlier in the week, and we had actually talked about it. And I know you're a big NBA fan, and to me, this has been percolating for a while. Kevin Durant has gotten into it. He's talked about it. Carmelo Anthony said in the last week he's, quote, done with the officiating. This has been creeping up for a while. James Harden has been very vocal. There was a game in Boston late last month where he was very unhappy with some calls in the final seconds of a game that Houston ended up losing, and I know that probably is exacerbated by the notion that Houston kind of fell into a little bit of a rut. Now we could see Harden back this week. But I think this has actually been going on for quite a while. It's definitely an issue that Adam Silver, the commissioner, and Michelle Roberts, the NBA Players Association president, have discussed. And as I mentioned with Trent and Ken the other day, this is something that has just come to bear the last couple of days, because when you wake up and see a headline like Rockets try to attack Clippers in locker room through back door only known to Chris Paul, like if that's the headline you see, it's going to get a lot of, whoa, where did this come from? But I think a lot of people like yourself that have been watching the NBA all year realize it's an issue. And here's the part that really makes it an issue. It's not just like random guys. You know, this is like Carmelo Anthony, James Harden, Chris Paul, LeBron James. I mean, this is like all of their A-list guys. You know, these aren't a bunch of like guys off the bench or marginal players having problems with the officiating. This is the biggest bold-faced names in the sport. And when that happens, it doesn't matter what the issue is. Now, this is obviously serious. We're talking about officiating the integrity of the game itself, and the top players complaining about it. If the top players complain about anything, let's be real. A couple of days ago, the Cavs lost to the Warriors in Cleveland, and after the game, Kevin Durant complained that there was no hot water at the queue, and that became like a big story. So anytime a big name in the NBA has even a minor bit of news, it's a big story. And if you take the biggest names in the NBA, more than a few of them, the ones we just reeled off, like Harden, Paul, LeBron, Carmelo, etc. And then you have a real story with the officiating, it's going to become a thing. It's been a thing for a while. I think it just really blew up here in the last 48, 72 hours.
Zubin, Chris Paul, he's the head of the Players Association. Seems like a good guy in the State Farm commercials. But that was a punk move. Because he played for the Clippers, he knew the back way in. That's a punk move. What was he doing?
You know, I'm really surprised by it because, to your point, and I know you're being facetious about the State Farm commercials, Chris Paul is generally a huge stand-up guy.
Yes.
Like, I don't think there's been really any problems. I mean, we live in a society where literally anybody wants to just nail everybody for everything. There was an incident a couple of years ago, extremely minor, which was, as usual, blown out of proportion by everybody, where he was, like, given 10 hours of grief because he went after, like, a female official. There was an incident a couple of years ago where he was, like, tossed from a game, and he said something like, you know, she shouldn't have made that call or something like that. And it was taken as some chauvinistic remark, which it clearly wasn't. He was frustrated after the game. People put two and two together. People want to spark a controversy on Twitter. And so it happened. I'm willing to give him 100% pass on that one. Anybody that tees up anybody in a big spot, there's going to be some anger after the game. But literally, I'm not kidding, literally, I'm trying to rack my brain for anything that Chris Paul has been accused of doing that has been untoward. And that is the only thing I can come up with. And that was generally seen as a complete overreaction. And it went away after like a day. He apologized. He said he was in the heat of the moment. The only reason I bring that little incident up is because that's it. And there's plenty of people that don't think that was a big deal at all. So he's generally had a very clean reputation. He's generally known as one of the NBA's good guys. Now, I will tell you, my guess is if you ask Doc Rivers if he's one of the NBA's good guys, he would probably say no. He definitely had some beef with Doc. Definitely it frayed, it soured. But I'm not going to hold that against him either, because I'm sure there are days that Steve Kerr and Draymond Green don't like each other. And I've seen LeBron publicly chastise Tyronn Lue the other day on the bench when they were getting housed by the Toronto Raptors. So in-game anger, coach, player, I don't hold it personally, because I am sure there are moments that the best players and the best coaches are at each other's throats, and that's why they're in the NBA, because they have that level of competitive juice. But honestly, I can't think of a scenario, a legitimate scenario, that doesn't involve two alpha males, that doesn't involve a star player and a star coach. Chris Paul's just been great the whole way through. He has been great the whole way through. So that's why this move, and you know, you referenced it as a punk move, and I think it could be seen as that by some people. I think by other people, it could just be an overreaction. I know the Rockets are a very frustrated team right now. The Clippers are actually playing pretty good basketball, to be honest with you, relatively speaking. But I gave you that entire spiel to tell you that basically I don't think anybody has ever said anything negative about Chris Paul in a serious way. So that makes this all the more stunning.
We're having a conversation with Zubin Mehenta, ESPN, right here on the Big Talker 1700. All right, Zubin, I want to stay with basketball, but this will be the college variety. Your alma mater, the Rutgers Scarlet Knights, began this week as a one-point favorite over the Iowa Hawkeyes. Now, heading into tonight's game, they are a one-point underdog. As an alum, can you stand for that? What's going on here?
Well, I think the biggest, besides whatever the Vegas spread is that they're not roadkill anymore. I mean, I don't think that's like a huge accomplishment. Let's give them a standing ovation because they're not getting mauled by 35 points. They are definitely a much tougher out. And for that sort of program, that's about it. Let's remember this. For all the stress you guys have at Iowa this year, I know you're hoping that Drake carries the day, and it's been a long time since that happened. I know it's been tough for Iowa lately. Really, this season's been really disappointing. I know for Iowa State, the expected step back was there. I know you and I generally is not playing the type of basketball that they're used to playing. But think about this. For all the problems that you guys think you have with your basketball school, Rutgers has not made the NCAA tournament. Okay, this is basketball, not football, where it takes a Herculean effort like Greg Schiano did to turn the program around, or what Hayden Fry did when Coach Fry first came to Iowa, or what Matt Campbell has now done in 2 years. I mean, like, huge rebuilding projects for Coach Fry when he first got there, for Campbell, for Schiano, Bill Snyder, you name it, tons of coaches that turned places around and taken them to great heights. But I would tell you this. When you look at Rutgers, they have not made the NCAA tournament since 1991. Let that sink in for a second. They have not made the NCAA tournament since 1991. It is not that difficult to make the NCAA tournament. It's gone from, obviously, the 64, 65 to 68. New Jersey produces a ton of great high school basketball players, a ton of them. Very few have opted to go to Rutgers. The few that have, many of them don't stay. It's a tough spot. But I would tell you that they are making real progress. They just extended their head coach, Steve Peichel. His contract is pretty good. Peichel was a long-time assistant for Jim Calhoun. He was actually a team captain for Jim Calhoun twice. And there's a lot of rumors here about Kevin Ollie. I think his buyout is very high. But if they were to ever go away from Kevin Ollie, Peichel would be at the top of the list, as crazy as that sounds. Not like he's done great things with Rutgers, but he has a great lineage and history at UConn. And I think that's part of the reason Rutgers athletic director Pat Hobbs signed Peichel to a bigger deal, because I think he knows he's got the right guy in place. He's not flashy. He's not going to win a ton of recruiting wars, but he's built Stony Brook, and that's probably the better answer for Rutgers, not to hire a hot flash in the pan that does something and then takes the next biggest job available. They need a guy that's committed to building it, and the fans have shown so much patience since 1991 that they can wait a few more years. The arena is small. It's not as big as Carver Hawkeye. It's not 15,500. It's not the 14,092 of Hilton Coliseum. It's about 8,000, but it's getting much, much tougher to get a ticket. The excitement is definitely back. They played Michigan State close at the Rack, which is their arena in New Jersey. They took them to overtime in East Lansing. So I think that for Rutgers, it's a moral victory that they're in games right now. They're still clearly one of the bottom feeders in the Big Ten Conference. I don't think there's any question about that. But they're far more competitive than they have been. 3 or 4 years ago, I don't care where they played Iowa, it would not be a one-point spread in either direction. That could have more to do with how Iowa is faring the last few years. But I definitely think that it is essentially a one-point game either way. Shows you that Rutgers is moving in the right direction a little bit, but it also shows you how down a lot of people are in Iowa for sure.
Zubin, we've taken a few paths down the memory road with Iowa basketball this week, the passing of Chris Street, the 25th anniversary. Did you grow up a Rutgers fan?
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
Here's the thing I would tell you about. There's just a little bit of a difference between being a Rutgers fan and being an Iowa fan. As you, Trent, obviously, you're probably one of the biggest Iowa fans I know. You have to run down the list of things in the New York, New Jersey metropolitan area in terms of the pro sports. And Rutgers is just so far down that list. I would almost like equate it to, you know what I would equate it to, Trent? I would equate it to being a Drake fan. Because, yeah, there's a lot of stuff to do in Des Moines. But if you went to Drake, you're a Drake fan, right? But you could go see the Iowa Wolves. You could go see the hockey team. You could go to the East Village. You could go down to Court Avenue. You could do all these sorts of things in Des Moines now. And Drake is just kind of like one of the options, even from a sporting perspective. There's numerous things to do. You could make the drive to Ames. You could go to Iowa City. You could do whatever. You could go watch the primetime league in the summer. There's so many options in and around the metro area that Drake is just one of them. And if you're a Drake guy, great, let's go to the Knapp Center. I know they're trying to build a lot of things up at the Knapp Center, replace the floor. I know there's a lot of things going on there from the people that I talk with and I'm still in touch with. But that's sort of like what being a Rutgers fan is like in New Jersey. There's just too much going on. We call it the tri-state area. You guys call it the metro. There's so much going on in the tri-state area that Rutgers is an option. But unless you have a tangential tie to the school, like you went there, or your son or daughter goes there, or you know somebody that went there, it's not like high in the list of things to do. Again, I'm not denigrating Drake here in any way. I'm just saying that when you think about what are we going to do, it's 50 degrees, it's 60 degrees, the snow's gone, and it's a mild day. There's no lack of things to do in Des Moines, but you have to be really ardent into Drake to say, we're going to not do anything tonight except go to the Knapp Center. That's kind of the way it is in New Jersey. We've got the Jets, the Giants, the Knicks, the Rangers, the Islanders, the Devils, the Red Bulls. I mean, you've just got everything and everything. The Yankees, the Mets, you've got everything going there. And so you really have to tap into that group. My bet is the people that go to the Knapp Center to watch Drake, at least this is the case when I was there, they're like at every game. They get the students, they get some elderly folks in there, and they're just passionate Drake supporters. You don't see a lot of people, hey, let's drop it on Drake once a year. It's like right. Either you're in with Drake or you're out. And that's the same thing with Rutgers. Mm-hmm. Nobody's just going to wake up and say, let's fight traffic on the New Jersey Turnpike to go watch a middling basketball team get blown up by 30 points. Like, if you're into it, you're into it. If you're not, there's just too many other things to do.
Well, I was going to ask you if you remember not their last NCAA tournament, but their second to last when they lost to the Iowa Hawkeyes. A bit of trivia here, Zubin. Keep this one in your back pocket. It was the last victory at Iowa for Roy Marble, B.J. Armstrong, and Ed Horton in that senior class as they were knocked off in the next round by NC State. So a little bit of trivia to carry around just for your future when you're talking about your Scarlet Knights and a connection to Iowa.
Listen, I will hang on to that until the next time they make the NCAA tournament, which apparently is not going to be this year or probably next year, which is probably something Hawkeye fans and Scarlet Knight fans have in common, unfortunately, at this point.
And Zubin, I'll give you one more little nugget that you can hang on to, is that yeah. I did on television New Jersey Nets basketball playing at Rutgers. Yes, I called some games there at Rutgers before the Nets moved into the Meadowlands area.
There's a lot of history out there. It's just a matter of rekindling it. Guys, you've got Karl Anthony Towns from New Jersey, DeJuan Wagner from New Jersey, Troy Murphy from New Jersey, Luol Deng, not from the United States, but played his high school basketball in New Jersey. Jay Williams, my colleague at ESPN, New Jersey. Dante Jones, many years in the NBA, New Jersey. Shaquille O'Neal, Newark, New Jersey. Tim Thomas, Patterson, New Jersey. The list goes on and on and on and on, and they just got to be able to grab just a handful of these guys, because if they had just gotten a fraction, and Jones did start at Rutgers and eventually finished at Duke, if they had gotten even a second one of those guys, any one of those guys, had they been able to get their hands on any one of those, the Hurleys, had they been able to get their hands on any one of these guys, maybe the situation is different. You guys live in a smaller population state, 3 million people, and yeah, every once in a while you'll get a Harrison Barnes or a Mayer or like a Dean Oliver up in Mason City, but New Jersey's got 8 million people, and it has got a ton of basketball talent. And they have not been able to grab those players. All you need is one here, there to make it happen. But that is apparently way harder and way easier than many people thought. They have just not been able to get it done. One guy can turn a basketball program. I saw Jeff Horner almost turn the corner with the Hawkeyes. I saw George Niang basically turn the corner with Iowa State by himself with some help and him leading the charge. You get the right one guy, you'll be fine. And they've had so many guys grow up in their backyard, and they just can't pluck him and have him stay. It's really a confounding thing.
Zubin, enjoy the game tonight. Are you working this evening? Will you be doing the halftime show for this, or are you going to be watching as a fan?
Tonight I'm actually going to be watching it as a fan, and I think it's going to be a close competitive game. I really do, and I'm not sure if that's a good thing for Iowa, but I definitely think it's a good thing for Rutgers.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, as always, for your time, Zubin.
All right, guys. See you next week.
Zubin Mehente from ESPN stopping in with us, as he does each and every week. So here we are, Jimmy B. Moments away from tip-off. Game 1, 6 o'clock. It'll be Iowa at the rack and then Iowa State at TCU. What do you got tonight, Jimmy B.?
Well, you know what? I know Zubin thinks it'll be a close game for the Iowa contest with Rutgers, the Scarlet Knights. I believe he's correct. I just don't know which team we're going to get out of Iowa. Are we going to get the first half team that we saw Iowa against Illinois? Or are we going to get the second half team that many fans believed that was the team that we were going to get from the beginning of the college basketball season? That's my dilemma on this game tonight. I don't know. Neither team is very good, so I'll take Rutgers just because they're playing at home. That's the only reason, Trent.
Iowa continues to move up the rung tonight. They took a step by beating Illinois. They moved from 14th up to 13th. They beat Rutgers. They take another step up. They get to 12th. They got Wisconsin, who's down there, coming up next week. Purdue in between. They're going to be moving up. The Hawks get the win tonight. Semi-comfortably, we'll say a 6 to 8 point victory for Iowa tonight. State TCU, then after that finishes up, we flip the channel over, go over to 208 on your Rockstar Direct TV, and you get to ESPNU, Iowa State at TCU. And no Jalen Fisher tonight for the Horned Frogs. Now, the number seems a little hefty at 10.5 when it opened up. But where are you going on this one, Mr. Brinson?
Well, I like the Fisher kid. I think that he's the kind of the guy that can race up the court, handle the ball, score in low double figures, and put a lot of pressure on your defense. I'm not sure who else now can play that point area for TCU. I like TCU's big man. You know I like Brazianski. I've always liked him. I thought he's got pretty good game. And TCU has run into some real hard luck. They have lost two games in overtime and then two other games by pretty much buzzer beaters. So this is at TCU. I think TCU finds a way to beat Iowa State tonight.
Inside the number? Less than 10?
And the number less than 10? Yes. I think Iowa State's in it. Mm-hmm. I just don't think they can win it.
With you there. They're going to go bigger tonight. Robinson will take over the point guard duties. They play with two point guards, basically. Robinson and Fisher in the backcourt are like two point guards. But it's going to be a lot more now on Robinson. You're going to see a little bit more, I'm sure, inside out of this squad. But I'm with you. The number felt too big when it opened at 10.5. I still think it is. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go with you. I'm going to take the Clones tonight to keep it close in that one. Jim, we're out of time, my man. We are done for the day.
I can't wait to get outside again and enjoy that warmth. 20 degrees. Wow.
Well, not anymore. It was sunny when you came. Now when you leave the studio, it's going to be dark and cold again. Good luck to you. Get that little beater heat up, and we'll get rolling. We'll be back tomorrow starting at noon. Myself and Ken Miller and then Jimmy B and TC each weekday from 4 until 6 o'clock. Real sports talk for real sports fans all here on 1700. Good night, everybody.